I did hear there were some questions about how do we stop corporations from manipulating us in evil, nefarious ways, but I thought I would start with something a little bit lighter. Maybe okay. We'll get to that. Your research has been very influential for me, and some people here know I have a bit of a shopping addiction. And the first time that I saw your research about both the shopping study and also about how dopamine surges when you're anticipating getting a reward, and then it starts to go down as soon as you actually get it, I realized that I could actually maximize my happiness online shopping by looking at everything I could buy, putting it in my cart, super exciting, dopamine. But if I actually went to buy it, that's when the insulin would kick in, and I'm like, it's gonna cost so much, pain. So now, if I want that little bit of dopamine boost, I just go internet shopping, and I just leave it all in my cart and don't check out.
That's exactly
what I do. Is it really?
I wish you'd see my Amazon shopping.
I know. Here's another
thing. It's been there a long time, too.
If you do that, they send you coupons, too. Oh. Right? So it's actually really strategic. But so that's how you think like a psychologist, apparently. Okay.
Window shopping.
Yeah, exactly. Window shopping. Is
as long as you don't bring your kids.
Yeah, because then their nucleus of confidence will just be like, buy me.
Yeah, they won't have the prefrontal inhibition to stay outside.
So I want to actually get a little bit more into this idea that the juice is in the anticipation. And one of the most interesting distinctions that I've seen made as an extension of your original research, showing that the dopamine is really surging in anticipation, is this distinction between wanting something and liking it. And how there is not always a good correlation between this activation of dopaminergic neurons that make you think something really good is going to happen. And so you have this inner experience of wanting it, not always correlated with the system of actually being happy or receiving pleasure after the fact. And it has struck me that in our culture, we are so convinced by the wanting experience that sometimes we don't pay any attention at all to whether it correlates with the liking or the satisfaction or the happiness that we are predicting is going to happen.
So there's sort of two angles that I think of to respond to your comment when I think of what you're saying. One is sort of the physiological level. So there are these amazing rat studies by Ken Berridge that you've probably heard of. He's a psychobiologist at the University of Michigan. And we were talking about facial coding, actually, off the stage there. Well, he does facial coding on rats. So he'll look at rats when he gives them a cue that they will receive something tasty like that.
Can you do the expression? Can you show them
the Google smile? Usually it's on plexiglass, and then they have these big snouts, and so you can see their mouths. But if you were to put sugar in a rat's mouth, then they would make kind of a licking expression like that. If you put something bitter like quinine, they would go like that, which babies do, people do too, right? Babies do too. And they've done these experiments on babies and they have videotapes of this. So he actually codes their faces. And the reason he codes their faces is because then he can manipulate the dopamine in their brain or the opioids in their brain, which is a different neurotransmitter. And his idea is that dopamine is more involved in this sort of what we would call appetitive motivation. So appetitive motivation is like when Pavlov's dogs hear the dishes clanking, they salivate, and they orient, and they look ahead, and they, if you have a dog, you know what I'm talking about, and they wag their tail and all that. Whereas the consummatory motivation is more about getting this food powder, licking it up, kind of enjoying the taste of the food powder. And by manipulating these different neurotransmitters, he can actually enhance the rat's appetitive behavior, so they're lip smacking and licking before they get the reward. Actually, it's not so much the lip smacking, it's just the eating itself. And once they've gotten that tasty reward, they'll smack their lips quite a bit, and he can separately manipulate that with another neurotransmitter called opioids. These are the kinds of, it's a peptide neurotransmitter, but it's the kind of neurotransmitter that is influenced by drugs like heroin, morphine, and so forth. And these drugs, and presumably this neurotransmitter in your brain, because your brain makes an endogenous, its own neurotransmitter version of this, makes people feel good, but in a very different way. It makes them feel calm and relaxed and good, as opposed to dopamine, which when injected into certain regions of your brain, will increase this appetitive behavior, this feeling good and excited. So Kent's done beautiful work on that, you know, looking at just not only the neurochemistry, but sort of the outward expressions of appetitive versus consumatory motivation, and before, trying to disentangle.
Before you go into your second extension of that, what I think is so fascinating is that there's this whole field of neuromarketing that is explicitly trying to manipulate the anticipatory response, the dopamine, even though it may not be doing anything to increase actual pleasure, so that you can be manipulated into the wanting when you're in the store, and then you get home, and whatever it is you've bought or you've eaten may not actually deliver on any of the pleasure.
Right. I mean, you could argue that marketers have always been doing that.
Yes.
But now they have sort of neural terms, the brain scanners,
and testing which advertisement or which smell is going to release the most dopamine.
Yeah, as people say they're doing this, but then I never know whether to believe this stuff or not. So this we'll go on off on another tangent about this problem. But you know, as a consumer of information, like you're reading the New York Times or something, if somebody makes some claim, like somebody did recently, 2 weeks ago or so, there was a guy named Mark Lindstrom who wrote a book called Biology, and he said, I did the largest neuromarketing study using brain imaging, and I found that your brain is in love with your iPhone.
Did you guys read this?
The insula was activated. And to make a long story short, nobody knows whether he did this study or not because it hasn't been published. And nobody can look at the data and evaluate it, okay? So this is problematic from a scientific standpoint, maybe not from a marketing standpoint. So it's really, when people make these claims, it's really hard to know who's doing the studies, what have they found, it doesn't replicate, that is, can you reproduce it, and so forth. Unless it's peer reviewed, right? And hopefully it replicated by other people. I would just say buyer beware. That was a bit of a tangent, but I think it's an important thing for people to know about the claims that are being made in the media, because it is true that we're able to do things now that we weren't able to do 10 years ago. I would have never in my wildest dreams thought we could look into the brain and actually predict what choice somebody's going to make. And so that generates excitement, but it also generates hype.
So speaking about media, I remember when when the sexy photo study first came out, the study that you show men sexy images and they make more risky investments, I remember there was a lot of media reports that were saying it was because of some evolutionary reason that when men think sex, they want to go out and they're going to take chances to get their mating opportunity. And I remember you being really irritated by that that interpretation of the finding, that it wasn't really consistent with your study or your scientific interpretation. And I just wonder, in general, do you think that the media gets your research or research in general right?
Well, I'm so happy you asked that question, because we have data right now showing that it's a follow-up to that study, where instead of using pictures, we use smells. Because I was commenting to somebody who came up afterwards, they were saying, well, what about women? Did you see the same thing with women? And the honest answer is no, we did not. So we weren't seeing women get as excited by the erotic photos.
They might have by the office supplies.
Well, maybe I didn't use the right red stapler, but we just couldn't get the same affective response. And so, you know, I stewed about it, and meanwhile, these media reports came out, and there are basically two interpretations. One is it's about the emotion. So if you get the right emotion, you're going to get this risk-taking behavior. Another is it's some evolutionarily conserved module of the brain that, you know, males see sexy women and they take risks because they want to look attractive to the women. Never mind that it's a photograph and they've never met that woman before,
and
they're never going to meet her again.
And she's already got a mate too, so that, you know, the opportunity.
But it's a reasonable hypothesis in a way. It's something you could test. I just didn't think it was right. So now what we've done is we've used smells. And it turns out both men and women really like good smells and really hate bad smells. Mm-hmm. And by good smells, I mean vanilla, and by bad smells, I mean garbage and onion oil and stuff like that. And so we've actually used those smells in that same paradigm, and we see, I think, I'm going on tape, so hopefully this will pan out the way I think, the same kinds of changes in the behavior of both men and women. So if I'm right, that's what should happen. If you see the same emotional change, you should see the same effect on behavior, basically. So I don't want to go on record saying this, but I'll say there's a high probability that my interpretation was correct.
But we'll wait until it's here.
Yeah. I mean, but I will say that, you know, for the most part, we've had really good experiences with the media. And I think part of it has to do with just understanding what the media wants, so that they want a soundbite. And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way at all. That's how the information is conveyed. So it's better if you provide that than somebody else does. And what happened in that case is somebody else provided soundbites. There's an amazing array of scientific media right now that I think is really great stuff. And so if you talk to those people,
they are interested in getting the story right and fact checking. There are outlets where they don't have a reputation for scientific veracity.
You want to give us a clue to what those are?
I'll let you surf the net and find out for yourself.
I want to ask you about something you opened your talk with, this distinction between the rational actor and the less rational actor. And you suggested that wisdom might be becoming more aware of what our irrational biases are. Mm-hmm. Daniel Kahneman just published a book. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. Anyone have it yet? Have you read it? I think it's supposed to be a really good book. Anyways, one of the leading behavioral economists. And he has pointed out that despite spending decades studying how it is that he himself is irrational and how all humans are irrational and making decisions, that awareness hasn't done a whole lot to improve the quality of his decision making. And I thought that was like quite amazing that he would cop to that. And I was wondering what you think about that. Has your own research increased your awareness as a consumer or as an investor, or in general, do you think that knowing about these biases really is enough?
I don't think knowledge is enough, unfortunately. I think it's a first step, but then I think you have to apply the knowledge in a way that's effective. And that's not always straightforward, either on an individual level or on a policy level. And so I actually think that's why we need research, both on an individual and policy level. So I think the knowledge is important to give you clues on what to intervene in. But because so much of this is happening so fast, I think under the radar of consciousness, conscious reflection, even if you're aware of it, it's going to usually be after it's happened. So there are things that I do to game myself. So for instance, I have an iPhone. I'm terrible about time. I'm like an anticipatory person. And so I get engaged in things. And so I have it alarm me when I need to go to the next appointment. It's a really dumb hedge, but you know, it works, and it has changed my life for the better, although it's not a perfect solution. I'm sure there must be many other solutions like that, that people could think, if I had a prefrontal cortex when I was doing this, here's how I'd set up the situation, right, to facilitate the long-term behavior that I want.
So we need to build a prefrontal cortex in our environment.
That's what computers are, right?
Yeah.
Well, not the only thing, but I think, you know, one reason to have a computer, I think these are like prosthetics, basically. And, you know, I don't know if you've read, who's the guy who wrote her romancer? Anyways, there's science fiction out there. William Gibson, yeah. So he talks about people putting chips in behind their ears and their heads, you know, and that kind of thing. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I think these kinds of prosthetics is...
There's a market opportunity right there.
Well, this is me drinking the Silicon Valley water, but you know, I can't help it, right? I'm here. So there will be prosthetics like this, not just for, you know, arms and things like that, but for foresight and for... And I don't just mean that you wear on your head, but in your environment and so forth. Cool. See if that happens.
So speaking of the market, the last thing I want to ask you about is this company, Consumerology.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it is they're doing and how they're using research to help people?
Yeah, so I joked at the beginning of the talk that, you know, I was the last person to be interested in money. And so now I'm an advisor for this board that is called Consumerology. And I just always find it amazing when academic research is in any way of interest or applicable to the real world. So what happened is this company, Express Scripts is what they're called, is basically an internet pharmacy. And what they found a very basic thing, actually, that very simple, what they call behavioral economic modifications could vastly change people's behavior, basically to improve their health. So what they could do is sign people up for a default program or not. They could give them the option of signing up for this program to receive medications in the mail. And what they found is that if you get medications in the mail, I'm not saying you can't go to the pharmacy, but it enhances adherence. So they found just by changing these defaults, many more people were adhering to their medication. And they found a similar thing with switching to generics, right? So if people were sort of default switched, they were more likely to switch. They save the consumer money and obviously the company, them money too. Other people maybe not. But the point is that they're interested in why is it that these really, they had economists on board, they're making all these projections, they were unable to predict or account for these kinds of massive shifts in behavior, right? And so they started getting interested in behavioral economics, and they called a bunch of people. One of them was Alan Garber, who is here. He's now the provost at Harvard. Another is Dan Ariely, who you might have heard of. He's a psychologist, behavioral economist. A bunch of people like this, David Lifeson, who I was mentioning earlier, an economist. All these people are interested in this intersection between psychology and economics and how to actually affect behavioral change in a useful way that will help both, you know, the consumer and the company. And so basically what they do is they invite us to talk to each other for a day, you know, once or twice a year. And I signed up because I thought, oh, I can talk to David, I can talk to Dan, I can talk to Alan, it'll be so great, you know, so, and it works, actually. They just have us brainstorm about behavioral economics.
And they translate that into things on...
They have a lab now, and they're looking at data and tracking all this data and looking at sort of behavioral bottlenecks, basically. One thing that they're really concerned about is medication adherence. That's a big problem. So you may know what the disease is, know what the treatment is, and yet people don't take their meds, so they don't get treated, and it's bad for everyone because it has a long-term cost. So they're trying to figure out, okay, how can we help people to remember to take their meds, or, you know, what are the other issues that come up?
Cool. So I'm going to turn it over to this group now, and I'll let you call on people as you like.
In your data, you showed that the anticipatory response is higher than when you actually get the reward. Mm-hmm. So is that universally applicable for any pleasure experience, and does that actually
We don't really know. I mean, so that's a very sort of a... Oh, yeah, sorry, I'll repeat the question, yeah. So in the first experiment that I described, where people thought they could make money and then they made it, what we see is actually a bigger signal in the nucleus accumbens.
Sorry, the battery's out.
A bigger signal in the nucleus accumbens. I can turn this off.
No, I think it's... I need to make sure all mine are on.
I speak loudly, so...
There, sorry. That was
oh, cool. Before people make the money. So it's really strange from a certain perspective. It's like, why should you get more excited before you've actually made the money? I mean, from an expected value standpoint, that doesn't make any sense at all. That number is lower because it's cut by the probability. But from an affective standpoint and from an evolutionary standpoint, I think it makes sense. Because when you should be the most motivated and energized is when you're about to get that thing. You want to seal the deal. Once you have it, it's a bird in the hand. So the question is, to what extent does that generalize to other scenarios? And the answer is, we do not know. So we're starting to branch out into financial risk-taking, shopping. We've seen it happen in those situations. The signal happens before the choice. It happens before people even know what their choice is going to be, because sometimes when they haven't seen the price is too high, so they say no. Sometimes it's not, they say yes. And yet this independently will help predict that they're gonna choose that item. So we're pretty sure that in many generalizable circumstances, even social decision-making, am I going to trust this person or not? Am I going to cooperate with that person or not? That you're going to see these signals before, and they will allow you to make certain predictions about what people are going to do. But we don't know how broadly it generalizes. Yes, and then... Yeah.
I wanted to know more how you would describe effective gambling.
Effective gambling.
Or efficient, sorry, you said efficient
gambling. Oh, yeah, right. So this goes back to a really old story about the concept of expected value, which is like the cornerstone of decision theory. And a guy named Ben Pascal and Fermat were corresponding in letters. Blaise Pascal was hired by an Italian gambler who was throwing dice, and he wanted to know how to bet on the dice. And this is a really weird notion for some of us because we've, you know, been raised to think that probability is always multiplied by magnitude, and that's how you get expected value, and that's how you should decide, right? So according to that framework, in a dice game, you should multiply the amount you can win by the likelihood that you'll win, right? And if another dice game offers either better odds or better magnitude of the outcome, that product is higher because you choose that dice game, right? So you can choose between gambles. And you can choose how much to gamble. But it turns out that until Pascal came up with this, people didn't really think about probability, and they certainly didn't factor it in a formal way into their decisions. So now this cornerstone came about sort of in the mid-14th or 15th century, and was a construct of the Enlightenment, basically. So now that's widely accepted, though, that if you're choosing between different uncertain options, you don't want to just think about how great the outcome is, but also how likely that outcome is. If you multiply those two numbers together, whatever option has the highest product is the one you should choose. So that's what I mean by choosing optimally according to an expected value.
So the efficient part is based on the odds?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I was using that loosely, but I just meant sort of, if you want to assess a whole bunch of uncertain possible outcomes and choose among them, according to expected value theory, this is the way you should do it. You just say, okay, what's the magnitude and probability of this, that, the other, whatever's highest, you pick that one. That's an efficient way to decide.
You mentioned that people with schizophrenia didn't respond as most people would when where the part of the brain was lighting up in the anticipation with the dopamine. So does that finding have any impact on future clinical treatment of people with, say, schizophrenia or anxiety or OCD, anything like that? Is there any kind of relationship?
Yeah, we think there might be. This is work that's mainly in collaboration with Andreas Heinz, who's a psychiatrist in Berlin. And what he's done is he's run these studies on a bunch of different samples of schizophrenics. Some first episode, never had medications in their lives. And that's the sample that I was talking about there. So even though they've not had any medication or intervention, you see this blunting of the nucleus accumbens response. And you also see that correlates with the extent to which they complain that they have no motivation, like they can't get out of bed and everything's flat to them. So what he then did is he treated them. So he treated them with conventional drugs to treat schizophrenia, many of which block dopamine receptors. And you can imagine that that may not help the situation very much. And in fact, you see the same profile in those patients. So you see a blunted nucleus accumbens response when they're anticipating reward. You see a correlation with amotivational symptoms. But then he treated them with other drugs that didn't have the pronounced effects on the postsynaptic dopamine receptors. Sorry to get technical, but that didn't have the same pronounced effect in blocking those receptors. And in those patients, he could actually start to see nucleus accumbens activation. And the activity was no longer correlated with these amotivational symptoms. So there's this notion that, even though it's early days, that maybe you could rationally select medications for people depending on their symptom profile using these kinds of probes. Instead of just putting people on whatever the first line medication is, waiting for 3 weeks, saying, that didn't work out so well for you, let's try the next thing, And I think it also validates the symptom profile, because I don't think many people do this, but you might be tempted to say, well, it's all in their mind, or why aren't they motivated? Well, it's just because they've never had a decent job, or but there's actually a marker that is consistent with their experience. And it turns out those amotivational symptoms are in some ways much more debilitating than the psychotic symptoms that schizophrenics often have, because they keep them from functioning at jobs and continuing their livelihoods.
What about like hoarders? People who hoard stuff, but then even hoard money.
Could
it help those kind of people as well, possibly?
It's possible. I mean, there's a really interesting dialogue in psychiatry right now about how one should diagnose disorders and then assign treatments. And the traditional way is to go to a book called the DSM-IV, and there are categories, and you look at symptoms and you say you have this, you have OCD, or you have schizophrenia, and what you usually use for that is this medication. But there's a movement to use these kinds of phenotypic markers and also symptom profiles, so maybe some subset which goes across different diagnoses, and use that to assign the treatment or medication. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next, I'd say, 25 years in terms of the diagnostic framework.
I was just reading the other day about a technique for helping to decide if you want to make a purchase or not, which is just to imagine a stranger either offering you the item you might purchase or the cash value of that purchase. Mm. And I'm wondering how things like that, like little tricks like that, or willpower in general, factor into the brain scan in that, like, if you were looking at the brain while trying to make a decision about a purchase, and part of it lights up because you're all excited about the item, and then you think about your credit card debt or whatever, and where would that fall, and what would that look like?
Well, we haven't looked at that, but I think you could see how the methods that we use could be extended to different scenarios. One situation we've looked at is something called the endowment effect. And the endowment effect is an effect, it's pretty robust actually, where if you own something and I ask to buy it, you're gonna request a higher amount than you would normally offer to buy that item. So basically, when people own things, they value it at about twice the cost. and this can get people into trouble, because if they're trying to sell a house or something like that, then they might need an intermediary because they're so attached to everything in the house. But people don't really understand why that happens. I mean, it doesn't make economic sense. In other words, there's a theorem, the Coase theorem, that states that states of ownership should not influence the value of something. So for instance, like a Picasso should be worth the same amount whether it's owned by a Nazi or whether it's owned by, you know, a French nobleman, even though it probably doesn't, right? But you know, the idea is that items have inherent value that don't depend on the owner. Well, that's not how people treat their items, okay? And I could actually do an experiment in this classroom right now. I could say, all the people from here on over get mugs, all you guys get pins, okay, and now that you've had those, who wants to trade? And usually when I do that experiment, less than 10% of the people raise their hands, okay, which doesn't make sense if your preferences are randomly distributed around the room, okay, and the items are of roughly equal value. But it works every time. It works in Psych 1. It's a great demonstration. You have to trust me on this. So that's an example of the endowment effect. And nobody really knows whether it's because you love the thing so much more because you own it and you really appreciate its good qualities, or you just can't stand the thought of losing it. Like, it's actually painful to think of giving that thing up. So we've done some research that leads us to think it's the latter explanation as opposed to the former. So you can imagine how you could use this kind of research to sort of deconstruct different components of purchasing and or selling decisions. That's just an example. It's not really directly relevant to what you said, but somebody might figure that out. So it would be an interesting avenue for future research. I've been biased over here, so I'll go over here.
Is there a way to get your brain to release more dopamine?
Yes.
Man, everybody wants that, huh?
Good smells.
You know, the funny thing is that there are probably many ways. And so obviously dopamine wasn't put there to respond to cocaine, even though it does. And so, you know, it's probably to help us to negotiate the social world and, you know, to get good stuff and survive. And so there are probably all kinds of natural stimuli. Like I talked about smells, for instance, and pleasant smells. Pleasant taste just a little bit, you know, like the salty peanut effect where you eat a little bit of a good thing and then you want more of it. So there are probably a lot of different situations that will elicit dopamine release, depending on who you are and what your preferences are. Drugs will elicit dopamine release, but bad things can happen. So if you keep doing it, you can deplete your dopamine, basically. The brain acts as if it's a very limited resource. And as far as we know, it is. We don't know a lot about actually how to conserve it or how to protect it. So that there are a lot of interesting questions that revolve around that. So my hope is that, I'm giving you sort of not a great answer, I'm sort of saying, well, lots of things, we don't really know what, but with these kinds of methods, we could actually figure that out. You know, we could say, okay, let's say, why don't you do this after you've run for 5 miles, you know, and see what happens. I don't know if our methods are that precise right now, but I think eventually they will be quite precise. And so you can imagine trying to enhance well-being, and not just the consumatory well-being, if you know, having eaten a lot of cheeseburgers, but the sort of anticipatory well-being, which I think is what really motivates us and makes life worth living. So, to be continued. So, way back there.
Can you explain how good smells would increase risk taking?
Well, we think, and we don't have the data yet. We know that they can, so we have that data, but we haven't put people in the magnet to look at what's going on in their brain. But our best hypothesis is that those good smells are acting on the same circuitry that I mentioned that were responding to the pleasant images, and that they're invoking that kind of anticipatory affective feeling, that kind of excited feeling, so they're acting through affect, if you will, to then heighten people's awareness of the potential gains in the environment. So when they see that gamble, even though the gamble hasn't changed, right, they're sort of focused on the gains. So they like feel lucky, to put it colloquially. And then they're more likely to go for that. That's our sort of mechanistic hypothesis of what we think is happening.
And is the theory that men and women have the same instinct to
gamble? Well, the gambles are really used as just a tool to get at this decision process. So there could be other kinds of decisions that one can make. Like, do you want to trust this random person you just met, for instance? That's also a risk. They could be nice, they could be nasty, you don't know. So the gamblers are just a convenient experimental way for us to get at that. So we suspect it generalizes to other decisions. But yeah, I mean, if we look at, in our lab experiments, if we look at how women and men gamble in our experiments, we don't see huge differences. So at least in our experiments, we don't. Let's have a go here. Yeah.
What about music? Is it harder to use because there are more individualistic responses than, say, smell would make more
universal? Yeah, great question. I mean, it's really fun, actually, right now in the research, because so many people have gotten these methods and looked at so many different things. So some people are looking at music. There are researchers at McGill, Robert Satori and Blood, a researcher who may be coming here next year, all have looked at music that people like. And it is very idiosyncratic, so it's hard to work with. It's also dynamic, so that makes it also, you know, tricky in the brain imaging setup to work with. On the other hand, there are some really cool markers of emotional responses with music. So, for instance, chills are a physiological sensation that you can actually measure with EMG. That some people experience in music. Often it's music that's highly pleasurable to them, you know, that is deeply significant. And I'm trying to think of her name. I'll think of it, but it's a woman from Robert Satori's lab who's looked at chills in the magnet, right, and what's happening in the brain. And lo and behold, when people feel chills, you see a nucleus accumbens activity. And it does correlate with how pleasurable they report the music being. So there is some indication that even though there's such idiosyncrasy, how people respond to music, and when they do, there's some linkage with these substrates. Somebody up here had a question. Yeah.
Yeah, this is related to the previous question.
Oh, okay.
If you expose the brain to multiple influences, say the smell or some visual stimulants, pictures, and then you do your experiment about risk taking, I mean, how can your brain be multiplexed with these different influences? Isn't it, if you're distracted with one, then the decision on a secondary matter is kind of affected by the first one, or can your brain really be multiplexed and independently?
Well, so there's a question about sort of multi-sensory input. So, you know, you might be smelling something, tasting something else, seeing something, there's lighting, and you ate something for dinner, and all of that, you know, is somehow influencing maybe what you're about to do, and how does it all get combined? And one answer is maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just sort of all has an independent effect on the decision you're about to make. But another hypothesis is there's some common currency type of calculations going on in your brain. So your brain sort of deciding, well, things are pretty good right now, or things are not so good. And if that's true, then there should be regions or a circuit that is sort of integrating those inputs into a hedonic representation, if you will. And so that's kind of our working theory, is that even if you're not paying attention to things, sometimes they might influence how you feel and might make it to this common currency representation. But it is true that what you're paying attention to obviously will probably have a greater impact on how you feel than what you're not paying attention to. Although there's some interesting evidence that things can get in under awareness or when presented subliminally and influence these subcortical regions of the brain.
We heard last week another experiment where people had to remember two-digit numbers and five-digit numbers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They remember easily that, and then we're exposed to another question about choosing chocolate cake or fruit salad. And there, the outcome of the experiment was they were so distracted by the first task, they would blindly, you know, do the second task.
Choose a chocolate cake. Yeah. This is Baba Schiff's research. Yeah, it's very interesting. And so what it suggests is you can't override, like, these influences. But if you take away that capacity, I think what I remember about that experiment is those were dieters. So those were people who were trying to watch their weight. And the explanation is that it takes some overhead to do that. So if you distract them with these numbers, then you see the subcortical impulse leap out, right? I wouldn't deny that. I wouldn't deny that. And I'm sort of talking more about things that directly impinge on the hedonic estimation as opposed to that are trying to keep it in check. I think that's a more interesting and complicated scenario. But I would also have different predictions. Like I would say the sensory roots are probably coming through sensory cortex, whereas this control mechanism thinking about what am I doing now? This is not what I'm supposed to be doing. That's probably coming from more prefrontal mechanisms, just based on lesion research. So you might be able to disentangle those using neuroimaging. Oh, great question. Yeah, so we actually were really fortunate. I had a great graduate student, Greg Samanez-Larkin, who got funding from NIA to look at the impact of age on some of these decision processes. So specifically, we focused on the first task I talked about, just when you anticipate getting or losing money, and then also on the investment task. And we were kind of surprised by the results, but we found a couple of things. One is that when older people... And older, I mean, we looked at people from 20 to 85. So, you know, 60 to 85. And we could look either, you know, in groups or sort of across the age range. When they anticipated making money, we saw the same kind of activation we saw in younger people. They got equally excited. When they anticipated losing money, we didn't see much going on in their brains. So, when they actually lost the money, then we saw, you know, signals that indicated that they knew they had lost money and didn't like it. This is actually turns out to be consistent with one of my colleagues' theories about aging, Laura Carstensen. She calls it the positivity effect. And one thing that you find as people age is that if you ask just people how they're feeling on a daily basis, that they tend to report, you know, similarly, if they're healthy, high levels of well-being as to when they were young. But in terms of how worried, anxious, all that stuff, that they tend to report not being as anxious or worried or feeling as negative on a daily basis. And we don't really know why. We don't know if it's they just, you know, get used to things, or they just are unwilling to go there, or they arrange their environment, they're wise, and they say, okay, I'm going to get rid of these things that are bothering me. You know, we don't know. But it's been replicated in several studies. So we actually saw evidence of that in the magnet, actually. Which was kind of interesting to us. The other thing that we saw is that when they're doing these risk-taking tasks, these financial risk-taking tasks, we thought they would take less risk than younger adults. That was kind of the stereotype. But they didn't. They took just as many risks. The only difference was that they tended to take more of the risks they shouldn't be taking. So that is to say, they tended to discriminate less between the two risky options. And we actually found that we could account for that based on the activity in their nucleus accumbens. We were scanning them as they did that. So there was a noisier signal in there. And when we, in a subsequent experiment, we gave them information about the expected value of each of the cues, then they looked like young people in their decision making. Young people got better too. But you know, based on the idea that this area is representing something about expected value, the idea was that if you inject the information in there, then it'll correct the problem, and it seemed to, at least in that experiment. So all that to say, we're in very early days, and we don't have there's very little data, actually, on just how healthy aging influences decision-making. We're just developing the experimental and neuroimaging tools to look at that now. Okay.
I was curious, if you have information, how much dopamine
We have not. Typically, these the alpha states are measured with electroencephalography, which is electrodes that are on this, you know, outside the surface of the skull. The problem with EEG, although it has great temporal resolution, you're sort of outside the skull. So any signals that are coming up are sort of getting baffled by the skull and dispersed. So it's really good for measuring sort of overall frequencies of activity, but not good for getting at the subcortical regions that we like to measure activity from, unfortunately for us, because it would be a lot easier if we could do that. So I don't know if anybody has done a really systematic correlation of, you know, when your nucleus comes is activated, or are you seeing alpha blocking in the prefrontal cortex, so for instance. I don't have any research that's looked at that. It might just be that the sources are hard to localize. Most of the sources in EEG are coming off the cortex, so they're sort of, the dipoles are lying like this next to the skull, whereas the dipoles in the areas we're looking at are all over the place and pointing in different directions.
I just wondered if there was any studies that had given individuals an ability to do biofeedback themselves with the dopamine.
Right.
Okay.
Well, so, yeah, so neurofeedback, has that been done? We're trying to do it, actually, with the nucleus, just directly with the fMRI signal. And we've had some success. We haven't published it. Because what we found is that if we give people the feedback, we show them, actually, the activity in that area, they can increase it, decrease it. The problem is we take away the feedback, they can't do it anymore. And the other problem is they can't do it for more than a couple of seconds, which we should have known. But we were going off of all the assumptions of the cortical people, you know, so which the cortex responds in very different ways. So we're still trying to figure it out. It's been hard because, you know, NIH doesn't want to fund that because it's pretty high risk research, and you know, people have failed, probably for good, you know, reasons, you know, that they weren't thinking about the physiology, including us.
So we can get high, but we can't get high for very long.
So far, that's what we're finding.
Unfortunately.
One last question. Okay, you had a question. Yes.
Yes, trying to see if you combine the risk taking, where you don't know the outcome or the value of the outcome, with actually showing them the value of the outcome with the pictures and the sound and so on.
Yes.
So people do know the value of the outcome.
When they know, like the expected value, for instance. Yeah. So in that one study I mentioned, we have, with the investment test. So we actually showed them the a graphical representation of the expected value of each of the gambles, and people did become more optimal. So on that task, you can actually quantify how many of their choices match the rational actor. And what I can tell you is that if you're looking at PhD students at Stanford, not a representative sample, their choices match the rational actor 75% of the time, which I thought was pretty darn good. And my colleagues in finance were absolutely horrified, especially when they learned that some of our subjects were their students. I think it's good, though. So now, if we go to the general public, which we have with these kinds of tasks, they get it right about 50% of the time. So there's a big difference. We don't know why. And it's not finance education, because you can look at, you know, humanities majors and you know, comparative religion PhDs, and they do well. So we don't really know what accounts for that. If we give people information, like in the community sample, we can get them up to that kind of 70%, 75% level of rational choices. But there is a ceiling. They don't do 100%. And we don't really know why, but I suspect there are probably a lot of reasons, but some of them have to do with sort of emotional biases, that they know they should choose that thing, but they got burned last time, and you know, it wouldn't be easier just to avoid the risk altogether, and you know, that kind of thing. So maybe we'll have better answers for the mechanisms for you in 5 years.
Well, on that note, we'll see you next week for our last class, and we'll actually be talking one more time about how to make good decisions, but we'll look at specific interventions to help people make wise decisions. Last class.
Thanks for the great question.